Ah, well, seems as though the intro has not played, which is always a good sign. So welcome everyone to an episode of the Daily Fred Show. I'm your host, Nicholas Larimer. And today I'm joined by, well, just Herman Pretorius. Herman, how are you?
I'm fine. I mean, we had Terrence until literally seconds ago when his power went. So now I just feel very exposed and vulnerable. But I mean, that it's my default setting. So
yes, no, things are, as you can see, things are off to a good start. But anyway, if Terrence's power comes back, he will be rejoining the show somewhere along. But of course, you know, this is the true price of service delivery, is that it interrupts our podcasts. And that's the real cost here. That's the real tragedy here. But let us start off with our first story today. And this one, I think, is fairly grim. A Gauteng health official, Babita Diokran, who is the chief director of financial accounting in the Gauteng Department of Health, was murdered on Monday in what police are saying is very likely a targeted assassination. Well, I suppose all assassinations are targeted, but a targeted hit, an assassination. She was a key witness in the Special Investigating Unit's probe into fraudulent COVID-19 personal protective equipment contracts. She's one of 300 witnesses, but she apparently was one of the key ones. She was really the center of things. Terrence, through a contact, knew her a little bit. She had a good reputation as one of the few people in the civil service who was really committed to her work sorry, I got distracted by someone in the comments demanding to know whether Herman was a fan of Roger Moore, which is from yesterday. Anyway, her murder is, of course, I think, quite chilling, because it really suggests that there's something very nasty creeping into our politics. I know that, you know, in Mpumalanga, people are always getting killed in connection with contracts and tenders and that sort of thing. And to see it happening in Gauteng is not very good, especially when it's someone with a good reputation. She pulled up outside her house as she was coming home, and a car was waiting nearby, and an assailant in the car shot her 12 times. So it's very definitely a hit. Herman, what do you think the effects of this will be on our politics?
Sure. I think one of the objectives of an assassination is always to instill fear. That's one of those key targets of organized violence is fear. I mean, it's where the whole idea of terrorism comes from, is to instill terror. I think how it'll affect our politics is one discussion. How it'll affect governance in our country is another question. I can't imagine that this will have enormous repercussions. Life in South Africa, we've seen, is unfortunately quite cheap, but it does dampen the ability, or perhaps even the willingness, of honest, decent civil service people to put governance and the public ahead of narrow self-enrichment interests by political decision makers. It's a tragic dampener on that. Just the loss of someone competent in a department as key as that of health in a time such as this is, in and of itself, quite a loss for Gauteng's people. Politically, I think it's quite terrifying, in the sense, exactly as you say, Nick, that political assassinations and, you know, offing people who can make life difficult for you is a well-worn stratagem of the ANC's patronage networks historically, up until, you know, relatively nowish, your more developed, your more in industrialized provinces like Gauteng, and, you know, perhaps a bit of Eastern Cape, I'm not quite sure, and of course the Western Cape. You don't really see that that those many political hits. But in the other provinces, KwaZulu-Natal and Mpumalanga, and even the Northwest,
particularly KZN and Mpumalanga.
Yes, yes, you do get this hangover from, you know, just the lawlessness of apartheid. That it's got this weird thing that when you're an organization that that you know lawlessness is so ingrained into your functioning, whether that law had merit or not, I do think it has a hangover on how you function thereafter. So the terrifying thing is that this is spilling over from the traditional or Wild West of ANC politics to your more, quote, mainstream areas where the costs are higher. So if this is a portent of things to come, I mean, South Africa really is in for some really, really difficult things. And we could perhaps get to this in a topic later, but it's fascinating always that when the failures of political parties are considered, you get the bizarre idea of the skin color of a candidate for one party being counted as a failure, where for another party, the failure of literally developing a legacy and a tradition of political assassinations is gangs, sort yeah. of on par.
Yeah, yeah. No, we will get to that. Yeah, it's quite shocking to me, and for a number of other reasons, which is that, you know, as we know, there's not an enormous amount of political will to go after corrupt officials unless they happen to be of an alternative faction of the ruling party. So usually only if you're associated with, I don't know, the Zuma faction or something these days, do you get corruption stuff pursued against you vigorously. And so for someone to get murdered over this suggests to me that we really have crossed a boundary in Gauteng, at least, into a much darker way of doing politics, and one that hopefully doesn't spread. And of course, the other big problem here is that, you know, I'm just thinking about if I was a whistleblower, how terrifying would be, not just because there might be people wanting to kill me, but because who do you go to for protection? Because of course, as we know, the South African Police Service, not only is it not that effective, not only does it not have very high morale, not only is it under-equipped, but it's also riven with gangs and infiltration and that kind of thing.
And I must say, something that's also worth, I mean, we at the IRR have had this experience where whistleblowers have approached us for several occasions, or for you know, several reasons, sometimes within the police, sometimes within government. And
I don't think there's a public figure in South Africa who doesn't get approached by whistleblowers occasionally, because that's
how widespread it is. And the quandary that you then face is, can you protect these people in some way? Is there some way that their identity can be kept safe? So already the lay of the land, as it were, isn't terribly encouraging for people within government or civil service to blow the whistle. Already the protections are you know, negligible at best. So the fact that an honest, decent person did the right thing and got assassinated for it, really, it sends chills down everything a chill can run down.
So Terence, we welcome on. I'm glad to see that your power is back. We've just been talking about the assassination of Babita Deokran. Do you have anything to add on that topic before we move on?
No, it's a symptom of very deep rooted pathologies that you know, not only are people plundering the state and public resources, but they're quite prepared to kill to maintain their access. And you know, unfortunately, this is violence has a long pedigree in South African politics, and one would have hoped that transition to democracy would have done something to expel it. Now, in some ways, if you look at the civil war between the ANC and the IFP and KZN, it did, but this governance by assassination, it's deeply, deeply concerning. What can be done to protect people like that? I don't know. I think at some level, you just hope that there is enough respect for the law, and that, you know, even your dishonest elements in society reckon there's certain lines you don't cross. You might want to burn documents, but not kill people. Unfortunately, we live in a society where that where many of those psychological barriers don't exist.
Oh, very much so. All right, let us. Oh yeah, Herman, you have something to say.
Yes, sorry, I was muted when I wanted to say it, and then I started speaking. No, I do think one thing to watch out for is this getting worse, because the carcass of the fiscus has been picked bare by predators and scavengers from the ANC. So there's a fiercer contest for limited resources, limited patronage. So there's more incentive to protect jealously the patronage you have, to be more aggressive, to get involved in patronage channels that you were not involved in if you're in the ANC. So my real fear is that this escalates, and I can almost not see a way of it not escalating. As the ANC dies a desperate and violent death.
Very much so. All right. Before we move on to our next topic, I just want to ask everyone who's watching and enjoying the show, please subscribe to our YouTube channel. Please leave us reviews on the podcast apps that you're listening to us on. And please hit that like button. All right. Let's move on to our next story. We, of course, have had... We've talked a little bit about the Zambian elections, which we think turned out much better than perhaps we feared. And today on the dailyfriend.co.za, if you go and have a look there, you will see an article by Jonathan Katzenellenbergen, who is one of our writers. Try saying Katzenellenbergen fast 3 times. It's not easy. He is, of course, also, I think, been a guest on the Daily Friend Show podcast in the past. But Jonathan's been writing about the Zambian elections. And Herman, you had some thoughts on the incoming president Hichilema's policies, what he said in his opening address, and what you think this means for Southern African politics.
Yeah, so something to point out, or something to echo that Terence actually pointed out just before the show, is that Zambia is sort of a unique situation. It's a democracy that didn't spawn into its current, you know, post-colonial iteration with enormous bloodshed and violence and civil war and, you know, armed struggle and so on. It quite had a relatively peaceful transition to post-colonial liberal democracy. And it's not quite a bellwether. It's difficult to see it as a bellwether because it's just, you know, very unique in several instances. But applying what we can learn from it to South Africa, one should also be careful. The two countries differ significantly, not least because of, you know, things like violent crime being essentially non-existent there and being massive here. But one thing that's very encouraging, and Jonathan does touch on it in his piece, is the fact that voters crossed ethnic lines in this election. I spoke to a friend of mine in Zambia, and they said that one of their the colleagues is of the ethnic group of President Lungu, the previous president of the PF, and the expectation should be in Africa, at least to all the naysayers for you know, something like democracy in Africa, that man should have voted for President Lungu, but he didn't. He made an ideological decision, went against the ethnic expectation, the identity politics expectation, and to a large extent, that is what swung the vote decisively in Hichilema's direction. It was a voter turnout of almost 71%, and Hichilema won, I think, 57.4% of the vote. So not only was it a healthy turnout, it was also a healthy majority. for the new president. And I do think that there are some lessons to take there, that this obsession with identity politics only goes so far. And it does show that liberal parties can seriously challenge the domination of Afro-socialism at the ballot box, and that South Africans might be inspired by that to think that issue-based politics is feasible and viable in Africa rather than just identity politics. And it's always difficult at the beginning of a presidency to look at the words. I mean, rhetoric is immensely cheap. It is very easy to lose sight of the reality of cruel politics in Africa. But I would urge people to go read that or listen to that inaugural address. It is quite something how out of his way the president goes to make the point that value-add activity is the way for the youth out of unemployment and poverty, that human rights, the rule of law, private property, economic growth, fiscal responsibility, that these things will be the watchwords of his administration. And perhaps an interesting note, if we consider what's going on in politics the world over, I thought it was very, very telling that the president expressly said, "The fourth estate, the media will be freed. Time has come for all Zambians to be truly free." And I just think that that is something quite unique. Is one might hate the media and despise the media and distrust the media, but it's rare these days, I find, for an African politician to, in their inaugural address, pronounce the liberty to be journalistically active. And my favorite line from the whole inaugural address was the time of caterism is over. So I think there's a lot to learn from that, and we can only genuinely hope and pray that the President Hichilema can actually implement this policy. It's not without its challenges, and if the lessons of people like Emmanuel Macri in Argentina is any lesson, it's that the Hichilema liberalism fight for Zambia has only just started.
Oh, very much so. Terence, do you agree with Herman's analysis there? Do you have anything to add? And also, how do you think this is going to reflect on the ANC? It's one of the sort of... It's a Southern African country now joining Botswana that's out of the kind of kleptocratic, socialist... I don't know what to call it, thieves club that has dominated so much of the region, its governments. I wonder what the ANC is feeling about Hichilema's election.
Well, I in a previous iteration of my life, I spent quite a lot of time in Zambia. And a few things struck me. While the quality of its institutions wasn't all that great, and while it had massive socioeconomic problems, it did have a very, very energetic and, in some respects, quite well-organized civil society. Its press seemed to be reasonably fair, reasonably free. It had a promising foundation to work on. In the late 1990s, as I recall, The incumbent president tried to extend his rule to from two permissible terms to three, and there was a lot of blowback on that. A group of organizations came together, they met at a restaurant called the Oasis and became known as the Oasis Forum, and they came up with some very intriguing methodologies to rally public support. You know, people blowing their car hooters at particular times of the day and that sort of thing. I think for me, Zambia was an example, albeit a very imperfect one, of a country that was sort of very slowly and painfully creating democracy from the bottom up, or creating the foundations of a free society. I think it's interesting to point out that the grand man of Zambian politics, Dr. Kenneth Kaunda, his party, the UNIP, ruled for something like 30 years before losing power. And I think two elections later, it wasn't even in parliament anymore. You know, when the fall comes, it can often be from a very, very great height. I think that what Zambia also, what Zambia has now that we don't, is that you have already gone through changes of power. The that liberation aristocracy, I don't think was ever as influential in Zambia as it was in places like Zimbabwe. And it's as you say, passed into a sort of Botswana post-liberation phrase. The question, though, is whether that issue-based politics, of which this, you know, seems to be some indication, can actually deliver on the socio-economic issues confronting that country. Be under no illusion, Zambia is desperately poor. But for that, it's a country for which I have a great deal of affection, lovely people, had some very good times there. So I'll certainly be watching closely.
Very much so, and hopefully they can be a little bit. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, sorry. Can I just I see in the comments that just one brief point. I know it's not terribly part of the discussion, but I do think it's something worth pointing out because it's an argument that we often see. Vernon Nayaga says here, the problem we face is a demographic one where we are multiplying at a greater rate than we can provide jobs. I do think that we should be very careful of that sort of thinking. It doesn't quite follow free market economics. Historically nor theoretically, in the sense that if your population is multiplying, you are creating increased demand for the jobs that you want to create. So with the economic freedom to satisfy the demand, those jobs will create themselves in proportion to the population growth. And as a case in point, if you look at China in 1980 to 1990 and India 1980 to 1990, the years in which those two countries liberalized their markets to a significant extent through and lifted essentially within a decade a billion people out of poverty, China's population grew by I think 170 million people in that decade, and India's by about 200 million people in that decade. So we should be very, very careful of this almost pseudo-socialist sort of thinking that there's a discrete amount of jobs and that population growth is a threat. With the right policies, a growing population is, if anything, an instigator for more services, better competitive economic circumstances. But yeah, sorry, that's a very, very much a side point, but I've seen it too many times and I do think it's something to address sometimes.
Yeah, I'd just like to add to that, actually. So it is worth pointing out, I think, that our population growth percentage is, I think, the lowest it's been possibly ever, at least since like the 1800s. And our fertility rate per woman, so that is the number of children that each woman has, is pretty low now. It's only just slightly above replacement rate, which is 2.1. So really the big problem in South Africa is it's not too many people, it's lack of jobs. It's the sort of clean way to put it. And this is actually an interesting thing that one day I think we should probably get into in the show, but is worth discussing, is that over the next century, the big problem in the world is not going to be too many people, it's going to be too few. Birth rates in every single country, except for, I think, yeah, I can't even think of one. you see birth rates declining pretty much everywhere and population slowing down. In fact, the UN is projecting that global population will peak somewhere around the year 2050, and then it's going to stay kind of flat. Now, obviously, you know, the world changes, history changes, these things don't necessarily go along in a straight line, but it is something to think about, is that in 20 years from now, we might be talking about how to boost population growth rather than rein it in. Anyway, that's off topic. Let us move on to our last topic for today. And this is the the analysis of the DA's mayoral candidates. So the DA launched it announced who its mayoral candidates were going to be ahead of time for all of the major metros. And Rebecca Davis from the Daily Maverick in particular wrote an article about the DA's choices of candidates for Cape Town. And she said, you know, the title of the article was, "It's Dry White Season for Cape Town's Mayoral Race." And I'll just read some extracts from that. "In a province where the majority of voters are neither white nor male, both the DA and the Good Party are fielding white male candidates for their Cape Town mayoral campaigns. It is a gamble that will not escape the notice of the ANC and other parties." She goes on to say, "Where the mind starts to boggle in particular is in the thought of campaigning Jordan Hill Lewis, who's the DA's Cape Town mayoral candidate, attempting to win the hearts and minds on the Cape Flats or in Cape Town's townships. Accepting the party's nomination on Monday, Hill Lewis said, 'I look forward to meeting you in your community and neighborhood in the months ahead.'" She also then goes on to say that it's extremely bizarre that the DA has a white mayoral candidate for Cape Town, a white premier of the Western Cape in Alan Windey, and a white national leader, John Steenhuisen. And then she suggests in this paragraph, "But all parties should also keep an eye on the ANC, which has completely revamped its candidate selection process going into these elections. For the first time ever, the ruling party has selected mayoral candidates following a nomination and screening process that will reportedly give way to postgraduate qualifications." Sorry, I could not laugh at that. So she does mention his qualifications and his character a bit in this piece. It's just not like she completely ignores it, but it's clearly not of interest to her. And I think this is emblematic of exactly the kind of shallow analysis that goes on in South Africa. Herman, do you have anything to add to that rant?
Yeah, well, in response to Rebecca Davis's nonsense, I will just say two words. Lynn Brown.
Yeah. Good enough. Terrence?
Yeah. Where does one still look? I mean, I don't know this guy from Adam and whether he's going to be any good. He doesn't have governance experience. Although it's interesting that people were doing cartwheels about Barack Obama in 2008 when he had no governance experience. In fact, I remember being interviewed by radio when John McCain had announced Sarah Palin as his running mate, and I said, "Well, what do you make of the fact that she's inexperienced?" "Well, actually, she's run a town and she's run a state. Of all the people standing there, she is the most experienced for the position that she's being put forward to. That's not to endorse her, but you know, it's facile. I mean, I love the phrase, as considered as racially problematic as the DA. Now, maybe the DA is racially problematic. I don't know, but you know, and if the goodness Davis, you know, doesn't explain exactly what she means there, does it mean that there's like white people in there and that's problematic? I mean, one could say certain things about the Daily Maverick being racially problematic and about Rebecca Davis possibly being racially problematic. I don't know. It's interesting that that Good also comes in for a bit of a shellacking, so because maybe Good's not so good on the whole race thing there. Although it's not as racially problematic as the DA, so I mean this is interesting. The ANC gets postgraduate qualifications. Okay, that's nice.
I also like the idea that having a postgraduate qualification actually really does anything to change the quality of governance. There are plenty of people who have ruined countries with a master's degree and plenty that have saved countries with a high school diploma. It's just stupid.
Yeah, you know, I really do get the sense, and you know, I'd be happy for someone to disprove me on this, that the platform for which Ms. Davis writes, and she's a good writer, I must say that, you know, is particularly invested in the seeing things through a racial lens. I remember her colleague at that time, Stephen Croteau, saying, you know, after looking at something the DA had done, said, well, but of course that doesn't deal with the central issue in South African politics, which is race. Now, if you want to make that argument, fine. What is, you know, but an assertion is not evidence. An assertion is an assertion. You know, everyone's free to do that.
And as our data and polling has shown time and time again, South Africans may talk about race quite a lot, but they actually don't care about it more than they care about things like jobs and the economy in general, that kind of thing.
Didn't Mrs. Zilwin lead the DA to a victory there, and she was also white and racially problematic. I mean, is that tautological? Is white racially problematic ipso facto? I mean, I'd like to have the vocabulary sorted out so that I'm not accused of being.
I'm also somewhat skeptical of the implication, although it's not outright said, that the ANC is going to do better in Cape Town because it's going to put up a person of color with a postgraduate degree, as if this enough will be able to swing the voters of Cape Town behind it.
A very, very brief thing for me. I know we're about over time. I just see Jesse Randolph's comment there on the flats. People already think of the DA as a white party. I have a feeling this will dent their vote in the elections. Unfortunately, people still see things through a racial lens. I mean, you could say that, and you might be right, but I really think people who make that claim should provide evidence. The evidence on the other side of the spectrum that race is relatively low on the priority list for South Africans is quite substantial. It might be wrong, but people claiming that there is this racialized nature of collective politics in South Africa should really come with the evidence. Because I worked for the DA for a while in Cape Town, and my interaction with people from colored backgrounds, anecdotally, was quite the opposite. I mean, all of them kept asking me, why can't we make Helen Zille president already? And that was after her time as leader of the party. So I do think that, yeah, there might be racially collectivist ideas dominating South African politics, but if you're going to make that claim, do back it up.
All right. Anyway, thank you, Herman, for opening a whole can of worms when we're 2 minutes over time. But anyway, let's see if I can get the outro to play now. Thank you very much for listening. We'll see you tomorrow. And we hope you enjoyed the show. Cheers, everyone.